You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, April 4th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ryan Grimm of the Huffington Post will be explaining a new global corruption scandal. No, not the other global corruption scandal that was revealed over the weekend, but one that was revealed last week. Unaoil, a Monaco-based firm that facilitated bribes across the globe for Western companies operating in the Middle East and elsewhere. Talk about how firms like Rolls-Royce and Halliburton and Hyundai work the international system to get contracts. Plus, Omar Aziz, he had a debate with he who shall not be named. Of course, he took him out of context, and we together will take him out of context on the program later today and talk about the general failing of American public intellectuals in the discussion on Islam and terrorism. Omar and I with a final visit on this Sam Harris saga and moving beyond it. Panama Papers were leaked. Global tax havens, evasions benefiting everyone from the Pakistani Prime Minister to the Syrian Air Force to the Russian President. More coming. And more that the journalists working on this project promise will implicate U.S. officials. But the real scandal, as many have pointed out, is what is actually legal when it comes to tax havens. It's about global inequality. It's about global corruption. It's about the infrastructure of 21st century corruption on today's show. And we got a bunch of sound. Hillary Clinton not helping herself with her dismissal of Bernie Sanders supporters. Reince Priebus says Donald Trump not helping the Republican Party. Wow, who'd have thunk it?
Ah, geez.
Ah, Margie. What the hell? What the Christ? Really quick, Matt. What is dropping tomorrow on Two Dope Boys?
We have crew member Georgette is going to join us.
Georgette Pierre.
Yeah, and it's going to be a great episode, actually. It should be up tomorrow morning.
And we're talking about, I think it's social media and religion, the Pope on Instagram. What else did we talk about in this episode? There's some broader conversation. A lot of the conversations that we take place usually get to the intersection of race, brands, and culture. So subscribe to 2db.com. I want to thank everybody. We're at 88 reviews on iTunes. Overwhelmingly positive reviews, I should say. And I really appreciate everybody's support. I'm so glad that we're building an audience for it. And I hope that if you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, you will. It's going well.
Yeah, and help us to get to triple digits on those iTunes reviews, too. It'd make us all just feel happy, I think.
Yeah, when we get to that 100, there'll be a general celebration in the office. And if you want a general celebration in your office, you need to be surrounded by the best people, which is why today's sponsor, ZipRecruiter, is absolutely essential for you and your business. Are you hiring, but you don't know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Look, posting a job in one place is not enough to find quality people. If you want a perfect hire, you need to post your job to all of the job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter, you can post a job to up to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find a candidate in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. This is streamlined and direct to the people you want and need. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. It's a lot of satisfied people. Find out. And right now, listeners who try ZipRecruiter for free can try ZipRecruiter for free going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And let me just say it one more time in the Bill Clinton voice. One more time, you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority and find the right candidates for you today. We also have a link to it on the Majority Report homepage. We will be right back with Ryan Grimm. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Ryan Grimm. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Ryan, how you doing?
Pretty good. What about you?
I'm doing great. It's interesting to be talking with you out of character.
Same to you.
Yeah, I don't think I've pretty much every time we've sort of spoken in the past, I'm like accusing you of being like some type of like communist vegan who is trying to ruin America.
All true things,
which
by
is
the way,
but no, I mean, even in character, I still do aggressive journalism. so it's kind of amazing. Like last week, and we're talking about this Unioil piece that you guys reported along with an outfit in Australia, and then over the weekend we have the Panama Papers coming out. So there's sort of like the infrastructure of global corruption is kind of getting laid bare over the past week in the same way that the Snowden revelations and WikiLeaks kind of showed us what the sort of other side of surveillance and drones and kind of global terrorism was. Now we're seeing how global corruption works. So to start us off, what is Unioil? And how did you guys get your hands on these emails? Like, give us the kind of setting point for this corruption scandal.
Right. Well, it is, and perhaps soon we think was, a company based in Monaco that serves as a middleman between global companies, most of them in the oil industry, and public officials in oil-producing countries. And so somebody like KBR or Halliburton would go, or Honeywell or Rolls-Royce would, because a lot of companies are involved in the technical side, the pipes, the meters, et cetera, mm-hmm. would go to one of these companies like Unioil and say, we want to get the contract, building the refinery in Basra. Mm-hmm. Get us this contract. And Unioil would say, okay, well, we want X percent, we're going to take X percent of it. And out of that X percent, they would bribe a bunch of government officials in order to try to get the contract or to try to get inside information about the contracting process. And Iraq told us that that recently they are moving, I think largely as a result of this scandal, to eliminate middlemen. Period. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't exist. If Honeywell wants a contract, Honeywell should put in a bid, you know, and meet with the officials, give their own PowerPoints. The middlemen, you know, really in general, are considered to be not exactly on the up and up. Like it's not you know, a company based in Monaco with its you know, registered in the British Virgin Islands, does not usually strike the ethics officers of Fortune 500 companies as probably, you know, doing the most up and up kind of work.
Right, and all of the language of like we're global facilitators, we're globally connected, but we understand mm-hmm. local customs. We do this sort of mm-hmm. vague amorphous, which is funny because the brand copy is so dull. But if you actually said we bribe public officials and hotels right. across the globe, that would certainly sound a lot more interesting. Kind of. Engaging as work. There's a whole region to kind of bribe and lay to waste. And I want to get to some of the specifics. You mentioned Iraq. There's also mm-hmm. Libya, Kuwait. What are some of the Iran? What are some of the ways?
Yeah, UAE, Syria.
UAE, Syria.
Nigeria, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan.
There's a whole world to bribe.
A lot of places where there are insurgencies. Mm-hmm. And what we found here is that it was the Western companies through Unioil that were actively corrupting the officials. You know, it wasn't that they were getting shaken down and they just had to pay this bribe as a price of doing business. It was more they wanted the competitive advantage and so went forward trying to slowly corrupt these officials, which is, you know, that kind of flips the Western narrative on its head.
That's a really important point because all you hear, you will hear, if you don't get the sort of upfront denials that, of course we don't do this stuff, the next layer of defense is, well, look, what are you going to do if you want to operate in Nigeria?
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay bribes in order to sort of grease the wheels. But what you show, and I'd love you to get into more detail, is actually no. It's much more often a company, whether it's, you know, I mean, again, very big brand names, and it isn't proven what they knew or didn't know, so we want to be, you know, careful about that. But as you say, based in Monaco, registered in the Virgin Islands doesn't inspire that much confidence. But companies like Rolls-Royce and Hyundai and Halliburton and all of these, they would, and what Unioil would do is they would basically start talking with, say, you know, a deputy energy minister somewhere, deputy oil minister, and mm-hmm. they might say, like, okay, well, how about... you know, as trivial as like a box of cigars, and then mm-hmm. let's just start moving from there.
Yeah, they and I described some of it to one of the FBI's longest-serving corruption investigators, and she said, "Oh, yeah, that's very much the MO. You know, you start with the basic stuff, with meals, with a nice shopping spree in London. Then you help." With you know, educating the kids, and in one case, they sent a kid to Dubai for 2 weeks for like an English course, you know, and then you know, you up the gifts a little bit, and then you know, and then once you've kind of established that principle, then you start talking, you know, amounts of money and bigger amounts of money. It really does go back to that probably apocryphal, you know, Winston Churchill anecdote. I believe it was Winston Churchill, you know, where he's talking to a woman, says something like, you know, would you sleep with me for $1 million? She's like, well, sure. I mean, anybody would. $1 million back in 1945. It's a lot of money. Right. Said, well, what about $5? She says, well, what do you take me for? And he's like, well, we already established that. Now we're just haggling over the price.
Right.
You know, so once you have kind of... you know, broken the seal of integrity by getting them to accept some little gifts, then you're just haggling over prices after that. And that was the process that would unfold rather than the kind of racist idea that we have that, like, oh, this is just Arabs who are just, this is their culture and they're just shaking people down.
Right, which is a very popular narrative, and that will get into actually the conversation that we'll have on terrorism and insurgency. But, you know, before we get there, do you think is it like, and again, obviously, none of these, there hasn't even been sort of charges outlined yet, so you know, we'll be careful. But is the appeal of a company like Unioil the sort of layer of plausible deniability? Because you said before, like, look, if, you know, KBR wants a contract, they should put in for it directly. If Samsung right. wants a wireless contract in Kuwait, put in for it directly. And so if these companies are using a global bribery facilitator, is the draw then of this whole industry like Unioil goes from the kind of like amorphous, almost like, we're almost like anthropological consultants and we help you understand mm-hmm. countries. It's actually like, no, I know money's going to exchange hands and I don't want to directly do it myself. So I'll hire this other dude to move it for me.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. The and so folks are up to date. I guess a day after our story, a lot of the executives' homes in Monaco and the offices got raided. And Iraq yesterday announced that it's opening up an investigation into Unioil. And there have been no convictions yet. But yes, they have a code of conduct that they refer to. We found four separate emails that where somebody accidentally got too forthright and descriptive about their business practices. Mm. And like at one, somebody mentioned backsheesh at one point. That one of the executives responded by saying, I don't know what Kevin is referring to when he says backsheesh. We all have a code of conduct that we have agreed to follow in all of our, you know, suggestions and emails. You know, we should never suggest that we don't follow that code of conduct, which is funny. It's like, well, if you don't know what backsheesh is, then how do you know that it violates your code of conduct? But we found four separate examples of that where they would speak too freely. And then somebody would specifically reference the code of conduct that they and you know say that nobody here should be ever suggesting that we don't follow our code of conduct. Now, you had asked earlier how we got it. It's mm-hmm. interesting. So this reporter in Australia, Nick McKenzie, wrote about Unioil several years ago in connection with another company, Leighton Holdings, and he suggested that. There had possibly been some corruption in obtaining some contracts, and he was actually sued in the UK for libel, and the UK has very tough libel laws,
right.
and he lost.
Wow.
And after that, somebody wrote to him and said, "Hey, you weren't wrong. It's way worse than you thought. And if you want to know more." To prove you're serious, take out an ad in this Italian paper with the code word Monte Cristo in it.
And so Clive Owen vehicle coming soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he did it to his credit.
Yeah.
He took out the ad. And that began a process of courting this source, which ultimately led to tens of thousands of internal documents.
That's amazing. So how does a company like Unioil start? Who is the family behind it? How do you say I want to kind of pivot from being a progressive YouTube pundit to a global oil bribery facilitator, which I probably shouldn't say
well,
on the public record. How do I get into that?
There might be an opening soon.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
So in the following the Iranian Revolution, the family that runs Unioil fled. They fled Iran and established themselves in Monaco, and started it then. It's all, you know, it's about connections. It's, you know, we legalize it and regulate it here in the United States, and you know, you have to, you know, send your bribes through different channels, and you can't, you know, really enrich. You can't directly enrich the public officials. You have to kind of, in the U.S., you have to wait until they're not public officials anymore, and then you can massively enrich them.
Right. Play the long game here.
Right. Whereas with this, it's, you know, it's just it's a lobbying firm that, you know, takes a more direct tack. So, but
it's
both
more
of them,
efficient lobbying, right.
Yeah. But both of them rely on on intimate connections and, you know, networks and who you know.
So you're just, you're basically just buying a social network that you can invest in, essentially.
Yeah, but I mean, and like with American lobbying, there's there's skill in it. There's skill in it too.
Right.
You know, there are some lobbyists who have just as much money to spend lobbying as another one, but they do it a lot better.
Right.
But yes, that's basically what you're doing.
And that actually is, you know, we were mocking the kind of language of facilitation and cultural understanding and policy understanding, but that actually is where a really good lobbyist is an equal part sort of bribe artist, influence peddler, and someone with a very sophisticated antenna for the environment they're working in, so that when they take the meeting in, you know, Azerbaijan or whatever, they, you know, like they know how to have tea with the person they're talking to. They know how to kind of roll the stuff out in a way that isn't going to offend somebody.
Right. And there is some, you know, if I were going to make the defense for an honest brokerage firm like this, it would be easy to do. It would just say, like, look, a Honeywell doesn't necessarily know, you know, which committees are the ones that you need to submit to, or, who you need to get your meetings with, and so, you know, it is reasonable to you know, when I've reported from Iraq, for instance, and I paid a fixer, like that's the term is a fixer. It's somebody who lives in Iraq and knows all of these people, and I said I want to talk to a Peshmerga officer, you know, somebody, you know, in the oil industry, and, you know, a Shia member of parliament or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the fixer arranges that. And there, you know, the fixer certainly isn't supposed to pay bribes. But I don't know how they're getting these interviews. I do understand how you could need that as somebody coming in. On the other hand, then, no, it's incumbent on the government to be as transparent as possible. And actually, the World Bank has a huge initiative, to their credit, trying to put a lot of these types of contract disputes or acquisitions online, and, you know, and to make them very transparent, so that anybody who's interested knows exactly how to apply, and that you can anonymize it in ways that benefit people who don't pay bribes, because that's the other problem of this, is it harms companies that choose not to engage in bribery.
Right. So the bigger picture that you guys draw in this investigation is that, you know, there's no mistake that this flourishes in environments of insurgency. And, you know, what occurs to me is we have all these kind of, hopefully, if you're doing it well, and, you know, the way I might hopefully have an interview or conversation or an article or something, have a discussion on, like, the rise of a group like ISIS, and it can get really abstracted, and you can talk endlessly about ideology and religion and this and that, and sure, those conversations have some value, and you can even kind of, you know, work it backwards and say, okay, without the invasion of Iraq, the disruption that caused facilitated the rise of these groups. But what you guys are saying very specifically in this reporting is that even beyond that, that the whole environment of corruption and starved infrastructure is really what is peeling away the resiliency and the ability of states that are facing really serious security crises to respond to them. So that all of a sudden we go from a kind of, you know, story of like Western vanilla, you know, being Western companies just sort of being venile, to no, actually fundamentally these sort of, you know, kind of silly sort of scenes in Monaco that could come from like a Bond movie are actually fueling some of the biggest threats that the world faces today, whether it's from terrorism or organized crime.
Yeah, that's right. And internally, a lot of the propaganda that that organizations like ISIS or Nusra or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban use is around the issue of corruption, both petty and grand corruption. Now, when they're trying to recruit misfits, you know, some 22-year-old misfit from France to come join the jihad, then they'll talk in more abstract terms about the meaning of life and religion, etc. But like in order to go from a radical movement in Iraq and Syria to a majority movement, then they talk a ton about corruption. Maliki's corrupt, Assad is corrupt, Gaddafi is corrupt, and people believe it on the grand scale, but they also experience it on the ground, and that, which leads to the second part of it, which is the amount of anger that is generated in these petty moments of corruption is hard to overstate, mm-hmm. and it creates a desire for revenge. You know, every time that you get shaken down by a police officer or a soldier, you get pissed off. Every time you've got to pay a bribe, just to get a meeting with somebody to get your license to, open up your business, which then you have to pay another bribe when they come by and say that the license you got wasn't on triplicate. So, give us another, $1,000 and we'll go away. Like it creates this anger. We talked to his author, Sarah Chase, who wrote the book Thieves of State, from her time. She spent like 10 years living in Afghanistan, running basically a soap factory outside the razor wire, with the Afghan people. And she noticed people who were very moderate liberal folks who had no love at all for the Taliban, saying, you know what, I'm not going to join the Taliban, but if I see them placing a roadside bomb, I'm not saying shit.
Right.
The army needs to feel some pain. That feeling that like there needs to be some cost for what they're doing. And then kind of thirdly, the idea that, that this kind of piousness that the Taliban and ISIS represents is not just an end in itself, but is also a means toward corruption-free government.
Cleaning
like, look, we're
corruption.
So we're so pious. Look at our beards. You know, we don't even shave. Think we're going to rob the people? No way.
I don't shave, but I will rob you. But the and when I'm clean shaven, I'll double it though. To be fair. But the one of the final questions that leads to for me as we kind of wrap this up is, and taking a bigger picture on this, a couple years ago it was revealed that HSBC was laundering money for drug cartels as well as Al Qaeda affiliates. Certainly, you could argue in some ways that cartel violence in Mexico is a more immediate security concern to the United States than anything kind of coming from the Middle East. And the question is when does, because it, when do these corruption issues from a regulatory and a governmental perspective start to get treated the way your reporting treats it, which is that this is a security issue. And you actually note in your reporting that some of the initial kind of development of anti-bribery and anti-global corruption legislation was reflected very specifically from a perspective that it undermined the United States in the context of the Cold War. It probably undermines us even more in today's environment.
Yeah, that's right. It was initially created in the 70s because the fear was that bribing companies, U.S. companies that were out bribing governments would undermine the image of the U.S. Vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and the kind of communist opposition. And looking at it, the Islamic State and the communists actually make very similar arguments about capitalism and said that this type of corruption is not an unfortunate side effect that comes along with capitalism. They said this is capitalism. And you have to uproot it entirely if you want to get rid of this, and you can sympathize with that argument. Well,
yes.
Well, sure. Okay. Because money changes. This is about money changing private hands.
Yep.
But this is okay, but this stuff over here is not okay. You can see why somebody would say no. All of it looks terrible. So you know, in our reporting for this story, Hillary Clinton did not come out looking very good.
Nope.
The issue came to her desk as Secretary of State in 2010, and she more or less dismissed it. Said, you know, we ought to, you know, we need to deal with corruption, but the military should actually take the lead on dealing with it. And she said that the kind of petty level corruption is a problem, but only only insofar as it does, you know, tick people off. The huge corruption, Karzai level stuff, that's only a problem. They said, she said, to the extent that it comes back to the U.S. and undermines support here. You know, the New York Times reports that Karzai stole money, and now the U.S. public is less willing to help Karzai, like that,
right,
that kind of thing. And the kind of mid-level everyday corruption, her memo said that's just part of how, that's just how things function. I think they even called it functional corruption.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty reflective of her sort of attitude writ large in politics, which is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's her kind of experience.
Right. Right.
It's like, hey, money changes hands and decisions are made.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Get stuff done. This company, Unaoil, certainly got stuff done. Final question, Ryan Grimm. Dude, why do you hate, like, America so much?
I don't know, man. I hate Panama more.
Well, I mean, look, like, I feel like they're trying of it at least to a degree. You know, Noriega was an entrepreneurial dude. Actually, you know what? I'm out of character, dude. There's no way that guy would know who Noriega is. Ryan Grimm, I really appreciate your time. We have a link to the reporting on our website. It's amazing, and I really appreciate your time, man.
You got it.
Thanks.
See ya.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Omer Aziz.
Listen to them, me a thought they took the fire. Hotter than a cup of coffee tea. A scotty beast and a boy like 40 soup. Why, oh, why, oh, when time is about from the station, people recognize everywhere when we go. Say other one, their name, Chronix. Watch it. Why, oh, back from me back, you don't know where we go. Could a sunshine, or could a heat, and this snow, me say, I mean, name, Chronix. Welcome. Teflon up a tampampa, we no big and borrow. Have a special sponsor excuse. Babylon a fret and wonder if we depend ganja and I make all kind of excuse. Give me the big
bag. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is journalist and law student at Yale Law School, Omer Aziz. Omer, how are you?
I'm doing well, Michael. How are you?
Doing very well. I'm really glad to be speaking with you. And we're going to open this conversation up because these Sam Harris conversations, or as we call them on this show, He Who Shall Not Be Named, really have bigger and broader public implications than just the sort of eccentricities of one kind of, you know, figure and his sort of culty followers. So we'll get there. But Let's sort of work this backwards. You wrote an article a couple of months ago. I actually had you on this program after the article came out. It was a very thorough critique of Sam Harris, and not just him, but the sort of broader collapse of public intellectualism that he represented. You talked a lot about history. You created a lot of context, or as some might call it, you were a member of the regressive left and taking him out of context and avoiding the real issues, which I guess would be the other way of spinning it. Now, Sam Harris invited you on his podcast, Waking Up, for a debate.
Yeah.
Why don't you take us from there? Because this episode is one of the most bizarre, deranged things I've ever heard.
Yeah. So he, after he saw that he could not ignore the article because people were sharing it and they knew it was a serious work and you can't just dismiss it as a lie or as dishonest, which is what he likes to do, he publicly invites me on Twitter to his podcast, right? Now, this is not how most people are invited to shows. He could have emailed me. He could have DM'd me. Clearly, he wanted to send his followers a message and show them how brave he was. And he probably thought, honestly, that I would say no because he hadn't heard of me. I gladly accepted. And then we went back and forth over email on how this was going to be structured. And, you know, naive old me, I guess I come from another generation, even though I'm 20 years younger than him, where people have sit down and have honest intellectual debates and discussions, no strings attached, no holds barred, right? Mm-hmm. And yet he wants to structure this conversation as me reading my article to him so that he could respond. Like, it was literally the most creepy and bizarre and strange thing to do, right? It was like, I mean, not even, if a professor of mine asked me to do that, I would tell him to buzz off. Like, who the hell do you think you are?
That sounds like something from like the Ike and Tina Turner movie almost. Like, it's the only thing that I could think of. It just sounds like, it's just creepy and weird.
Yeah, I mean, like, literally any other way to structure this conversation. And I challenge anyone to name me a journalist or an anchor or an intellectual or writer who would dare to do something like that, right?
Well, I'm going to start next week. It sounds pretty fun. Yeah.
Every single person should read their critiques word for word.
Yes.
But, you know, I understood how these guys operate and that had I said no, he would have said publicly that, look, here is a critic who challenged him in print and is not, you know, is sort of ducking or dodging debate. I knew that's what he would have said. And look, you can say anything about me, but that's one thing I won't accept, that I'm ducking the debate.
Sure.
And so I did, I went on and I did that. And I, you know, it did feel really strange and weird to read it to him and to hear him respond. But
it's just so, you know, weird, man. Okay.
Yeah, I know. But thankfully we did move away from just reading the text and being able to go back and forth over over some of these issues. But yeah, you know, the best parts of the conversation with him were when we were not engaged in the in me reading the text. But again, it's really weird because whenever, you know, the conversation is moving in an interesting direction, he can say, and he did say this multiple times, well, get back to the text. Why don't we, you know, let's do this systematically. We can talk about that later. Get back to the text.
Right.
And so that to me is like, it's such a sideshow, you know, like how someone can be so unself-aware to try and structure a conversation like that and not think that it makes them look bad. I mean, what happened to commitments to truth and to honest discourse, right? And then this guy is calling everyone else a liar and dishonest. I mean, it just boggles the mind, the level of unself-awareness that someone like that has.
Yeah, so moving from there, I, to be blunt with you, I listened to about half of it. I couldn't take it anymore at a certain point, to be really transparent. But it seemed like, and this is what's interesting to me, there's a substantive point, and then there's what only could be called really just an emotional point, which I think actually might lead us to some places that, you know, are kind of awkward to talk about in a public forum, but I think that they might be getting us somewhere in terms of kind of understanding Sam Harris and this sort of kind of odd movement around him. When you sort of got to the merits of the issues, what's very interesting about this whole exercise is that since Sam Harris has begun his collaboration with Majid Nawaz, whose book they put out together was the sort of launching point for your initial critique, Sam Harris did something where he kind of actually he conceded some really fundamental ground, because he kind of came to prominence with this sort of, you know, first it was the sort of I'm the unapologetic atheist, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, you know, the intellectual version of like Frank Gaffney or something, which is that there's something just really wrong with Islam and it's fundamental and you can't change it and nothing, you know, and it cannot, change cannot come from the inside. Change will come either from, you know, from fighter jets and my columns. And that's the only way. with his collaboration with Majid Nawaz. It's really interesting because Majid Nawaz, who is another character who you can, you know, I want to hear your thoughts on. But Majid Nawaz, for all of his sort of embrace of this kind of role of, in, you know, talking about Islamic terrorism, which sometimes he's right on, sometimes he's wrong on, I think, from a policy perspective, he has acknowledged and argues that you can reform Islam from within the sources of the tradition. And Sam Harris, according to that book, which I have read, and their talks, he's kind of reluctantly gone along with him, which is interesting because substantively that was the big argument that people like you and I think had with Harris, at least philosophically. And then, of course, getting into the policy and everything, he's a disaster. But the second, so what the debate seemed to take place on was on this sort of emotional grounds that Sam Harris is personally deeply aggrieved and upset that he has been, you know, deemed a supporter of torture or deemed a bigot. And that at this point, it's sort of his own kind of emotional umbrage, which frankly seems to me like that's where this whole project came from, his own sort of emotional infrastructure around these issues.
Yeah, I mean, he seems surprised by the fact that you can make controversial arguments and not create controversy. You know, like he couches his words in very controversial ways. And you're right. I mean, I'm happy to talk about the substance any day of the week. And again, in the second article that I wrote, I gave him an open ended invitation to debate and discuss these issues, which I know he'll never take up because if we're on equal footing with the moderator, I'm not reading my damn text to him, you know, on his podcast with equal rules. You know, it's very different. But the worst part about the podcast was, A, this, like, fixation on his motivations, right? He was like, he was trying to convince me of his noble motives.
Right.
Well, look, there's two ways to know someone's motives, right? I mean, essentially, you can't know someone's motives. Either you can take their word for it, and that's not a standard that I'm going to apply to myself. Otherwise, I would take every public person's word for it when they said that they were doing things for noble reasons, including politicians, right? Imagine that world where we just listen to everything everyone says.
I'm sure he meant it for the best.
You know, their own.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or you can infer motives and intentions and a general vision from action, right? Like, you called his book a book. I mean, it was actually an email exchange that was supposed to be a blog post that was published as a book. And in that book, there is nothing original or new that is argued. And it's something like 120 pages. And so from that, and by the way, Harris has made no serious study of Islam. It doesn't seem like he's even tried to talk to experts about it. It doesn't seem like he's visited any Muslim countries. It doesn't seem like he knows many Muslims. So from all of these facts, I inferred that, okay, he's an ideologue who uses Islam as his platform and to create controversy, right? He wouldn't be invited on Bill Maher's show or, you know, which I think got something like 3 million views or all this sort of attention without the comments that he's made about Islam, which are actually inaccurate and just bloated and inflated in terms of the threat that they perceive. But again, on the substance, you're right. Like, or actually not on the substance, huge part of the podcast is devoted to what other people have said about him, right? Murtaza Hussein said this, and such person said this, and some Muslim on Twitter said this, right? I mean, it was just so bizarre, and to ask me my reactions to these people, it was really strange. And I don't know any other public intellectual or journalist really who is in the public sphere and whines about the controversy that they receive. So, I mean, on that point, but again, I really wish that he would have talked substance. And when we did talk substance, I noticed that, you know, it seems as though he hadn't really learned much about Islam or studied it much. At one point at the end of our discussion, he asked me this question, you know, where or how many Palestinian Christian suicide bombers can you name? And, you know, my jaw dropped for a moment because I knew that he was asking this question 10 years ago. You know, there's a YouTube clip where he asks Scott Atran, the anthropologist, where are the Palestinian Christian suicide bombers? And Scott Atran says that there is this organization called the PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, that is mostly Marxist, mostly Christian, and they do suicide bombing. That was in 2006. I gave him the exact same answer to the exact same question 10 years later, and yet he clings to this idea of, oh, this is practically a science experiment, right? I mean, just to forward the thesis that Muslims are somehow uniquely predisposed to suicide terrorism because of their religion. Again, we can't technically call that racist because Islam is not a race, but it's certainly an orientalist and bigoted viewpoint, right, that doesn't stand up to even the smallest, the minutest amount of scrutiny.
Yeah, and also, I think this is where, you know, let's widen the aperture here, because the problem is, you know, twofold. One, and this is what I've always said, there's sort of two tracks of this critique. I think generally it's not a good or positive thing to, you know, otherize and essentialize groups of people or be bigoted, right? I know that that's, you know, that's super regressive, that's super cucks or whatever. I get all that. That's totally fine. I'm willing to, if that's what that term means, then I embrace it happily. Insofar as I can tell.
Just a quick question. Yeah. Just a quick question to the
please.
Critics. Is it regressive to suggest, I mean, because the analogous in America would be that, oh, all black people are criminals, right? Or black people commit a disproportionate amount of crime, therefore they're uniquely predisposed to be criminals. The same way that Muslims, you know, majority of the suicide bombers and terrorists are Muslims, therefore Muslims are predisposed. I mean, the really regressive position, I think, the real regressive and reactionary position, which again, the critics are not, his followers aren't intelligent enough to understand this, is to paint a broad brush of an entire group rather than to actually be able to isolate, you know, the criminals and the terrorists and whatnot.
I think that actually, no, that brings me to my second point, and this is where it's also important. I mean, it's important on this, you know, human and civic rights level, but it's also important on the level of people who are serious about understanding terrorism and serious about understanding security threats. So you need to get into the type of detail and distinction that allows you to understand, as an example, a group like Hamas that does engage in terrorism, but also has is also a political organization, is also an organization that from a realist perspective you can do business with, to distinguish from the Iranians that have, you know, horrible domestic human rights, that have definitely funded terrorist groups, but clearly have, again, a very realist orientation in foreign policy, and a version of Islamist politics that has, I would say, legitimate politics in it, right? As distinct from a group like ISIS, which really does represent this sort of genocidal apocalyptic strain. So even right there, mm-hmm. you're already getting in and you're making these distinctions. What happens with Sam Harris and, as you would say more disturbingly, the followers and the cult that's kind of forming around him is this profound commitment to not have any of the serious conversations under the umbrella that the only serious track you can take is to not be historically informed, not to know about policy, and not to have analytic rigor. And I think you would say that this is a broader collapse of kind of what public intellectual work is.
Yeah, I mean, Islam is one of those topics where you can remain completely ignorant and, you know, wedded to ignorance and naivete, and yet still command a public platform and have tons of attention. It's as though no amount of study is required of Islam, of the Middle East, of the Muslim world, because it's in the news every single
day. It may hurt you, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, in terms of his followers, though, I received many thoughtful emails that I hope to respond to that were substantive, that were nuanced, that were thoughtful. On Twitter, though, I guess it's the medium that just brings out the worst in people. And so, you know, people making fun of my voice and people, I mean, followers of his just doing all kinds of things. I really feel bad for them. It's almost like, you know, how can you be so offended that someone challenged this thinker that you admire? I understand that you like him, that you admire him. But yet, if you are a free thinker and if you're into free inquiry, that's something that you should welcome. You know, this goes back to Socrates, of all people. No one is above criticism.
Well, Socrates is a regressive, though, to be fair, Omer.
Yeah, of course. Do you think Socrates would have his critics read their critical articles to him?
Well, no, which is why he's a regressive.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but I mean, I just feel bad for them because it's like, you know, there's so many thinkers out there, so many brilliant minds, so many books that you should read and, you know, engage in this quest of knowledge and truth, and not to, like, just get so offended and emotionally respond this way, right, when your leader, when this thinker is criticized. It really reminds me, I've said this before, it reminds me of, like, Muslims and Christians that I've debated with. When you criticize the prophet, when you criticize the religion, they just have this knee-jerk reaction, and all of a sudden, you know, they go descend into name-calling. Like, you're dishonest, you're unethical, you're a liar, all these things. I mean, I don't take it seriously, really, because at that point they've already conceded that they can't engage in a substantive conversation.
Right.
But it's really frightening. You know, it's really frightening that how these cults form in really unsuspecting places.
Absolutely. So, and the reason, again, that this matters is because there are all of these important issues that are, that do sort of circle around these questions, whether it's, you know, Muslim civil rights in America and Europe, whether it's, you know, what is the balance between national identity and multiculturalism? What is a strategy for dealing with terrorism? I mean, what, you know, there are so many important questions that are here that, again, having this one-dimensional, monochromatic, stupid conversation about it does not help. From your perspective, yeah, what is the project of sort of not just Muslim, but also just sort of more general intellectual leadership, but also specifically Muslim as well, I guess both, and that you think is needed in order to deal with some of the challenges that these conversations bring up?
Yeah, I think that a serious study and serious debates about these issues, the most contentious, controversial issues, we should be having them, but reducing it to, you know, this kind of whining about so-and-so misrepresented me and quoted me out of context. And it's just really playground level. You know, right, let's have a serious debate about Islamism. Let's have a serious debate about foreign policy. Let's have a serious debate about how we want the world to look like. I mean, that's really the fundamental question, right?
Right.
That intellectuals should be asking, what kind of world do we want to live in? And the thesis I was trying to advance with Sam Harris before, you know, he kept cutting me off and saying, let's go back to the text, was that I want to see a world with, you know, vis-a-vis Islam specifically, where the leftist and progressive opposition is empowered in all of these Muslim countries, because it, right, does exist.
Right.
Women, you know, intellectuals, liberals, scientists who have often taken to the streets for democracy but have been suppressed by dictators that we've supported or because, you know, of terrorist organizations.
Does our drone policy in Pakistan help Asma Jahangir and her work against corruption and human rights? I mean, that's a, yeah, specific question for Sam Harris. And I frankly doubt he even knows who Asma Jahangir is.
Yeah. I mean, I think Michael Flynn, who was, you know, Defense Intelligence Agency or someone senior in the Pentagon, did say that. And in fact, even Stanley McChrystal said that.
Yes.
It's counterproductive, the drone policy. But the point yeah, I'm getting at is that I'm not into this, you know, let's pick individual voices out of the Muslim world who are brown-skinned, people like Majid Nawaz or Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and tell them to lecture 1.6 billion people about how they should live their life and how they should reform. What I want to do is create movements in these countries to advance a progressive and liberal vision. Because when a progressive, A, that requires democracy, because when there is democracy in these places and you have progressives and liberals who come to power, the cultural change that they'll implement will be permanent, right? If we're talking about changing culture, if we're talking about changing attitudes, that's a long-term project, and individuals that we just pluck out and we hold up as tokens are not the people who are going to do that, right? I'm not a fan of prophets, whether that prophet's name is Majid Nawaz, whether that prophet's name is Jesus Christ,
mm-hmm,
you know? And so I want to talk about creating movements. And in general, like that's going to be a longer-term project, and it's going to require serious intellectual study and support. It's not this sort of game that we've been playing as of late with, you know, let's just talk about isolated verses, isolated from the wider political and social and economic context.
Yeah, the last two kind of fragments I want to touch on before we wrap up is, I mean, what always occurs to me in these conversations is that, you know, a religious text from thousands of years ago that has been translated and moved across the globe that has endless sort of two main strains and the many sub-variants within that
yeah,
text and that tradition, you just need to read a couple of quotes and you're good. You understand it. but of course a kind of, you know, pop atheism book from Sam Harris that's written for a kind of general high school and college audience is apparently completely impossible to understand unless you have like the magic Sam Harris decoder ring. And as a final thought, would you like to share your Onion headline that you told me about, that your Onion headline that you felt sort of summarized this whole conversation?
Yeah, I mean, every single time Sam Harris talks about Islam, I'm just like, the Onion headline that should be displayed is, rich white guy in the Bay Area has an opinion about Islam, all caps. Right? I think that like that really captures it. I mean, and I just want the point.
Yeah, please.
The point that you made about polls and isolated verses. You know, you're right. We would never study America or study India just by looking at what the polls say, you know, what polls of Indians say. I just got back from the Middle East. I was in Israel, I was in the Emirates, and I was in Turkey, three very different societies.
Right.
And I was just thinking, like, if I tried to understand these societies only by looking at polls, or if I tried to understand Palestinian Muslims or Turkish Muslims by reading the Quran, I would come to absurd, illogical, inaccurate, just flat-out wrong conclusions, and I would think I was an expert, right? This is one of the problems of the world, is that all the intelligent people are so unsure about their conclusions, and all the fools are so sure that they're experts.
Right.
And this is something that we need to combat, I think, and that's going to take complexity and nuance, and we need more history-rich and more informed opinions about these contentious issues.
And as a final point, you know, you're exactly right. And that does not, you know, the other problem that comes up in this conversation, and I think it might just be due to like a collapse in like humanities education or social science education, is that it does not mean that you condone anything. I want to have as sophisticated and rich an understanding of why people support Donald Trump as possible, including people who are supporting him for what I would deem to be very valid but misdirected reasons, right? I want to know in detail and in full kind of view what is driving behavior, even of things that I fundamentally don't condone or support. And I've had conversations, you know, whether on Twitter or other mediums with this sort of group of people and Harris followers and people in that vein, and they will completely equate like an explanation of, you know, earlier Ryan Grimm said one of the reasons the Taliban or groups like that can, you know, grow in support is because they're perceived of as pious and therefore anti-corrupt. That's not obviously a supportive statement of the Taliban. That's a reality. But people will say, oh, my God, I can't believe you're saying the Taliban isn't corrupt, or I can't believe you're saying, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood delivers social services and therefore they deserve to be empowered. Those are value neutral descriptive statements that give context. And again, I don't know the line between disingenuous or just simply inability to kind of comprehend these things, but it shows a complete lack of what you're talking about we need.
Yeah, I mean, certain groups of people, you know, you get the stream of information, and you're able to deal with complexity and to form theories and to readjust your analysis of the world as more information comes in. And yet, then there are other groups of people who just, they can't deal with complexity. They have to cling to their conclusions ideologically, right? Islam is the problem. Muslims are deranged. Let's all focus on the text. Here's what the polls say. So you have someone like Sam Harris repeating his lines 10 years later to me, and that is a fault in our public discourse.
Right. Well, Omer Aziz, I appreciate immensely your role in the public discourse and talking with you. And I'll just say up front, taken out of context, unfair, completely misrepresent. We'll see you on Twitter, everybody. And I'll talk with you soon, Omer. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. All right, everybody, we got to get right to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to us on iTunes, even if you're a member. Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and write Two Dope Boys a review on iTunes. Majority Report kickback for Jet.com and Amazon. Those help us out tremendously. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. See you on the flip side.